Are you hot now? You're a little uncomfortable already. What do we have a game plan for that?
I'll make one.
Is anyone selling snow cones, or what could we do about this?
Just come to the front. We're just about
there. You're just right on the front. Well, there's just one place left, though. That's the problem. Oh, okay. Gaynell, she says thermostat maybe on this side, too. Way over here. Well, we'll get that adjusted, and we'll do our very best to make you as comfortable as we can. Hope you'll come back at 3:30 if you can. I know that that topic looks a little stiff, the doctrine of holiness. I know that that does really look kind of imposing, and you think 3:30 in the afternoon, I don't know if I can face that. But it really is about God's call for each Christian woman and each Christian man to be different. God calls us to be different. And so we're going to talk about the different ways in which God looks for us to express our Christianity, and a little bit on the doctrinal aspects of it. But basically, I hope that it will be a practical lesson, and I hope you can come back then. We're talking at 11 o'clock today about developing a Christian disposition. You know, it was a little disconcerting to me a few years ago when I began to think about the fact, it's kind of ironic, that you can go through life and, you know, you can be a really good neighbor. I mean the dependable type of neighbor, the reliable neighbor. And you can go through life being a good citizen, the person who pays all her taxes and obeys all the laws and does everything just according to Hoyle. And you can go through life being a good citizen, a good taxpayer, even a good church member. And by that, I mean attend all the services, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, go to ladies' Bible class, work in the bus ministry, get involved in all kinds of things, sing every song, pray every prayer, give your money very faithfully. You can do all those things, be a good neighbor, a good citizen, a good, quote, church member, and still be a poor example of a Christian. And maybe that doesn't sound possible to you at this moment, but I hope we can talk about that in a little bit and share some ideas there. I think it's what I want to really talk about this morning is a little bit in the area that's sometimes called the sins of the disposition, or the dispositional attitudes that we have. We sort of make a really heavy cleavage between sins of the spirit and sins of the disposition. And it still seems possible to me in so many ways that we make such a difference in the way we feel about committing certain kinds of sins, but other kinds of sins we're sort of blasé about. We don't think much about at all. Let me see if I can illustrate what I'm saying in a little more concrete way. Think about your own minister at home, if you will, just a minute. I'm sure there are a lot of congregations represented today. What if on this next Sunday night your minister showed up for services drunk? You know, what if he came to the foyer and he was just flailing around and talking loudly and sort of stumbling and making all kind of commotion and just, you know, all these very uncharacteristic behaviors? I wonder how you, just try to imagine this, pardon me, minister's wives, if you're here. Just try to imagine. I hope this is hard to imagine, isn't it, that you can do this? How would you feel about that? I think I'd be flabbergasted. I mean, I think I would just be outraged. I think, it'd be time to call a committee together and think in terms of getting a new minister. But let me illustrate it this way. That's a rather noticeable external thing. What if you had a minister and you realized after a certain amount of time in your midst that he was a person who was extremely tight with his money? He really hated any spending a dime. He hated giving his money, his wife grocery money. He hated spending any money for his children to have good clothing or maybe have certain advantages. And you just found in him a very stingy and closed spirit. I wonder how you'd feel about that. Well, I think in some ways we probably would have some tolerance there. We wouldn't consider that grounds for firing him, would we? And you know, if you really take the broad view there, I think either one of those maybe behaviors would make him kind of a poor advertisement for Christianity. And so we're saying then that in so many ways we make a difference, but is that really a valid difference as far as the scriptures are concerned? I think one of the things that's very hard for us to do is hide our own disposition. In this day and time, we're so cued into images. We talk about body image, and you have a political race, and you always find that the people behind the politicians are trying to create an image. If you go to speak to the elderly, then you want to create the image, I'm really in tune with you elderly people. If you go to speak to young people at college, then you want to create the image, I know right where you college students are, and I'm with you all the way. And so we're sort of into the idea of creating images. But I think so much of that is our own self-deception, because in spite of the fact that we think we can create images, they really aren't very successful. Was it Franklin Delano Roosevelt who said, you can't fool all the people all the time? And that's true about our disposition. We may present ourselves in certain ways to people, but sooner or later, by some nonverbal, if not verbal cue, we have given ourselves away. It may be a look that goes across our face. It may be almost an automatic response that we have with something about ourselves, or maybe a word. In other words, it's hard to conceal our disposition. And I think our disposition is, after all, one of the most effective or ineffective evangelistic tools we have. We're either drawn toward the Savior or we repel people by the personality and by the disposition that we have. I guess one of the best illustrations to me in the whole Bible of how a disposition began to make itself known is the story that we find in Luke 15 of the prodigal son and the elder brother. It's such an interesting story, and we're all familiar with it, how the young man called for his inheritance and left home and spent all that he had and wound up eventually having squandered his living in a pig pen. And you remember how the scriptures say that this young man came to himself and he said, you know, I don't have to be here. This is not where I belong. I have a father who loves me, and I can go back and I can tell him that I'm sorry for what I've done, and I really can have a different life from this. And so we have the story of the prodigal son who returned home. It's a real interesting study, I think, the study of the elder brother, and that's where we're going to be concentrating today, because I think it's in this story that we sort of do a flip-flop. I know when I first began studying the story of the prodigal son, I thought, what a terrible son this prodigal son was. You know, how he grieved his parents, and I'm sure that he did. And what a dutiful and fine and righteous son the elder son was. But you know, as I really get into the story of the elder brother and the prodigal son, I began to have almost the opposite feelings, because I see a young man who is willing to admit his mistakes and confesses those. And on the other hand, I see an elder brother who doesn't have much movement in his personality. We read about this elder brother, and we see him first, I think, when the elder brother comes back. And suddenly there is rejoicing in a household that's had grief. And there is celebration, and there's excitement. I can just see this house at night, and I could just see all the lights on and the music. Probably the musicians had been called in to play. And there's an area of a feeling of festivity and frivolity and excitement and gladness and reunion. All these wonderful things going on. And then I see the picture outside of this elderly brother who is very angry over what's happened, and who's standing on the outside refusing to be a part of that. You know, I think I learn a lot about this elderly brother even from the beginning. I get the picture of the elderly brother, or the elder brother, that he could have been content all his life with the knowledge that his brother was in a pig pen. It didn't really bother him. What did bother him is when his brother came out of the pig pen, and when he came back, and when he made confession, when the celebration started. You know, I love the picture of the father, though. He's such a compassionate father. Of course, it's an allegory of God. And we see the father coming out, speaking to his son, and he entreats him. Come in. You're a part of this. We want you to enter in with this. And the elder brother says, no, I'm not about to do this. I've worked here all my life. I've done everything I knew to do for you. And instead of bringing in a kid and having a party and a celebration for me and my friends, no, what you do is you turn around and celebrate and applaud the person who's done the very opposite of what he should have done. And the father, you know, understanding where this young man's coming from, I says to him, now, son, listen, I want to get this straight with you from the very beginning. You are ever with me. You're part of me. And I love you with all my heart, but I want to tell you something else. What we're doing is only right. It's appropriate. Your brother who was dead is alive. And this brother of yours who was lost is found. And so what we're doing right now is appropriate, and we want you to be a part of it too. But in Luke 15, I think the last picture we really get from that implication there is a miserable, unhappy person sort of slinking away into the dark. It's kind of interesting because in their own way, both of these boys were prodigals in their own way. I know the Bible doesn't use the word prodigal. That's a word we've used. I thought for 100 years it meant runaway. Of course it doesn't, does it? It means someone who wantonly, wastefully spends something. It's kind of the opposite of frugal. And you know, this young boy has wasted a lot, this prodigal son. He's wasted his time, he's wasted his effort, he's wasted his inheritance, he's wasted his body, he's wasted his intelligence, his talent, all of that. He was prodigal in that sense. And yet, you know what? The elder brother is also prodigal. But he's wasted his life in good and decent living. He's wasted his life in good and decent living. He's the young man who has this aura of new mown hay about him. He doesn't have the stench of the pig pen about him. And yet he confesses by this confrontation with his father, it doesn't mean anything to me. I don't care about any of it. So in that sense, he's really wasted all that he's had until that point in time. And I think there are a number of ways in which we can go through our lives and become prodigal without even realizing it. Of course, the person who never becomes a Christian is a prodigal. A good person, possibly. A fine person. A humanitarian, for all we know. And yet this person is wasting her life in the kingdom of darkness if she's not a part of God's kingdom. And I think there's another way we can become prodigal. When we leave the church, when we go into that figurative far country and we start living riotously, I think that's also possible, and you know that it is, and we've known people who've done that. But here's the area I'm concerned about today, and I think it touches us much more closely. I think it's possible to stay right here within the church, to go to all those worship services, to teach a Bible class for 25 years, if you will, and waste our lives in good and decent living by not having the right motivation and not having the right attitudes about it, by doing it for the wrong reasons. I think that's something where we all have a real danger, don't you? So we want to talk today about developing a more Christ-like disposition. And I do say developing it and growing it because it's certainly something that's a lifelong process, isn't it? It's not something that just happens to us. You don't stumble onto a Christian disposition. You work at it. You pray about it. You seek the Lord. You abide in His Word. It's a lifelong process. And I think it's a process we can do a little bit of checking up on. I think most of us could today do a little bit of introspection and think back even a year ago. Well, let's see now. Where am I as far as this attitude is concerned? Have I gone backwards? Have I made a little bit of a progress in this? I think we can begin to see ourselves growing year by year, and it's important, I think, that we apply that and we do make that introspective look. Well, let's talk about the elder brother specifically today. I think the first thing that I notice about this elder brother is the sin of envy. You know, envy doesn't get much press. You don't read much about envy. You don't hear much about envy. It's not preached about. A few years ago, I was trying to teach a ladies' Bible class on envy, and I guess one of the characteristic things I usually do is try to think, now, what have I heard on this subject, you know? Do I remember any lessons or any points that were made about it? I couldn't remember a single lesson that I had ever heard on the subject of envy. A book I read not long ago, written a long time ago by a Roman priest, in which he described his life and his experiences and 50 years of sitting in a confessional box and hearing everything under the sun confessed. He said that in 50 years of listening to confessions, nobody had ever confessed to anything. I wonder if that's because we don't do it. I don't know. I think what's so dangerous about envy is it's so hard for me to recognize, and I spot it in you right off, but it's so hard for me to see that in myself. It's very hard for me to see it, as a matter of fact. You know, envy is the sin of little people, somebody has said. I know this, that you can start in the Old Testament. And you can follow, literally, a river of blood in the trail of tears all the way through the Old Testament, winding up in the New Testament, related to envy. And you can start with Cain. You know, Cain killed Abel, not so much because his offering was rejected, but because his brother's was accepted, because he saw somebody else making progress. And that kind of gets to all of us, doesn't it? And I go along and I look at Joseph. How could brothers subject their own brother to something as terrible as flinging him in a pit and then selling him as a slave? Well, you know, I'm not going to give Joseph a medal for diplomacy because I don't really think he deserves one. And maybe there's something to say about that. I think I need to be very aware sometimes in my own speech and in the way I approach people that I don't cause them to feel envious. Now, I know I'm responsible for my sin. When I envy, God counts that on my ledger book, so to speak. But at the same time, I think that I need to be aware of that. And Joseph was not. And these brothers, motivated and impelled and frustrated by envy, did what they did. And then I look at Saul, one of the great, great kings of the Old Testament. You know, a man who had everything. And before long, his life was ashes because David's popularity began to eat and gnaw at him at the very center and core of his being, and he simply couldn't handle it. And then if I just trace that on even into Matthew 20 and the New Testament, I find the Pharisees and the Sadducees did not kill Jesus because he was a heretic. Oh, they threw out a bunch of empty accusations. But what killed them, what got to them, was the popularity of the people. And their authority began to be questioned. And their position was jeopardized. And they couldn't handle that. And in fact, the scriptures very carefully spell that out, that it was because of envy that the Jews sought to crucify Jesus. They were unhappy over his success. And that does have a tendency to get to all of us, doesn't it? I think it's something we all have to watch. Are you miserable in some part of your life right now because of envy? Something good that's happening to your neighbor, to your friend, to somebody else's child or grandchild? That has a way of coming in and really destroying our happiness, doesn't it? But you know, God provides an antidote for envy in 1 Corinthians 13. Three little words. The capsule that says, love doesn't envy. And you know, it doesn't, does it? Love does not envy. You think about your own children, your own sons, and your own daughters. I can tell you right now that Jeff and Greg are not going to get a wife that's too good for them. How about in your family? You're not going to get a son-in-law or a daughter-in-law that's too good for your child. And your children are not going to have opportunities that they don't deserve, or you don't think they ought to have. Deserving is another question, isn't it? But you don't think they ought to have. And you're not going to feel jealous and envious when they are able maybe to have some blessings in their life that perhaps you didn't get to have because you love them. Brother John Stewart, who's dead now, was a wonderful gospel preacher. Didn't have a lot of formal education, was a Christian that influenced so many people. And his son was able to get the PhD degree. And Brother John used to say, "Oh, I'm so glad David got that. I'd a lot rather he had it than I get it." And he meant that because he loved David. And love just doesn't envy. You can't be unhappy over somebody's successes when you do love them. Years ago in Scotland, there was a very well-known preacher by the name of John Alexander White. John Alexander White was a rhetorician. I mean, he knew how to deliver in an articulate and compelling way the gospel. And people were mesmerized by him as he spoke. And he just got all these opportunities to go and speak and teach people. And before long, at his own church, the people began to say, "Well, you know, Brother John is so busy with so many other opportunities. Let's get somebody to come in and kind of fill in for him, you know, fill in for him while he's gone." So they got a young man by the name of Hugh Black. And these two men really worked as a team, and the newspapers always had a lot of fun with those names, as they always do. They used to say Black and White, White and Black. In the morning, White preaches. In the night, Black preaches. And they'd say, in the morning, White blackballs the saints, and at night, Black whitewashes the sinners. And they just went on and on and on. Well, Hugh Black was a very bright young man himself, and he watched someone whom he admired, and he sort of said, "You know, I can learn from this man." And as John Alexander went out, White went out and began to speak at these various occasions, Hugh Black's confidence and experience began to grow. Before long, he had blossomed into his own person. And he became a person who could really speak to people and reach them and influence them. And as time went on, the very normal thing happened, where as the older man sort of began his descent, along came the younger man and his ascent in that area. And he began to draw bigger crowds than John Alexander White did. And things seemed to go very smoothly. Well, years later, when John Alexander White was discussing this with a friend, he was very candid one day. John Alexander White had a very gentle and lovable disposition, but one day he confessed to this friend that had been kind of hard for him to watch that happen. And the friend said, "Oh, I don't believe it," because he loved John Alexander White and he knew what a good person he was. He said, "I don't believe it." And John Alexander White said, "You may not believe it, but you do not know the black depths of the human heart." And I have thought so much about that. We do all have our black depths, don't we? We do all have those areas where we really have to struggle to have the right attitude. And maybe you can say, "Well, this is not me. I never have this problem." Well, fine, you have another one just as bad. Because we all do. We have those black depths, don't we? And I think if we will look today and look into our own hearts and find if there's not some unhappiness there because somebody else is succeeding, somebody else's husband is prospering financially, are gaining recognition in a way that we are not, it would help us to be aware of that. Well, the next thing I noticed about the elder brother, keep wanting to make him elderly, don't I? Elder brother is he became angry. He became angry. You know, that's something I think we don't worry too much about. We just sort of take it lightly. I mean, we've sort of grown out of the last 15 years especially where we've almost deified anger. Hooray for anger! Let's ventilate it. Let's spread it around. And let's really get rid of that problem. And I want you to understand that I think that it's good that we have anger. It's a God-given emotion. I'm very concerned about people who can't get angry, but it's there and God gave it to us. And if you don't believe that, well, walk down a hospital corridor next to a nursery and look in there and see those little babies going, and those little backs just as stiff as they can be, you know. So it's normal and it's natural, but what we're talking about is the way in which we handle that being either a plus or a minus. Actually, the scripture says some very pointed things about anger and how we deal with it. It's addressed seriously. I think what we're warned about most of all is an unhealthy, uncontrolled expression of anger, in which you just unleash a swath and cut it across everyone you meet. There are all kinds of reasons why people feel angry and feel hostile. And a lot of the time, it gets back to the idea that we don't like who we are, or we don't like what we're doing, and we're not very happy in those roles. It may be, as I said in the other address this morning, it may be you're trying to live with too many expectations for other people. It may be that you're trying to live with too many expectations for yourself. You know, the scripture puts an important perspective on this matter of anger. Listen to Proverbs 16 and 32. He that is slow to anger is greater than he that taketh a city. And he that ruleth his spirit is greater than the mighty. I am my world's number one problem. And what we're talking about here is the greatest battle any of us will ever face. And that's the battle for self-mastery. And I think any time we become out of control and get into a habit or a pattern of anger expression, and there's a negative side to this when we stuff a lot of anger and then we get into resentment and bitterness and a lot of things that happen there. But I think any time we don't handle that anger in a healthy way, we're really getting into an unhealthy situation. An interesting study was done a few years ago sort of comparing the effect of intoxication on alcohol with intoxication on anger. We're learning now. Did you know this? We're learning that instead of ventilation being totally good, that perhaps it's not the best thing to do a lot of ventilating, because in the ventilating, it becomes addictive. You've done that, haven't you? I've done that. You think, okay, now I can just say this much, and I'll be all right. But before long, that leads to this and that and that. And please don't misunderstand what I'm saying at all, because we do need to express our frustrations. We just need to do it in the right way. But that's important, and that's healthy. But in this study that compared the intoxication on alcohol with intoxication on anger, they found out some of the same almost physiological responses. There was a trembliness. There was a perspiration in the hands. There was adrenaline flowing into the bloodstream and people losing inhibitions, that kind of thing. Now, I wonder, which is worse, to get drunk on alcohol or drunk on anger? I wonder, in God's sight, which is worse? I guess I wouldn't know, because I wouldn't want to say. But I think that that's part of the tendency we have sometimes to sort of gloss over those expressions of destruction toward other people and maybe get very excited about something as external as alcohol. And that's not good, of course. But I'm talking about keeping that in a sense of perspective. If this is a problem for you, I think for women mainly it is a problem of stuffing, and that's why we get into unhealthy expressions. But sometimes I think if we can, and sometimes there are deeper psychological reasons why we don't handle anger right. We don't have time to go into all that today. But I think one of the things we can look at anger is as a habit sometimes, something that can be learned, and it was learned, and it can be unlearned. Now, that is, the expression of it is a habit. I need to make that clear. The expression of it is a habit. You probably learn how to handle your anger by watching your parents or by watching your teachers. Now, it may be that you imitated that, or it may be that you were so repelled by that that you learned to do exactly the opposite. But I think if we would learn to sort of think in more rational terms about our anger and start maybe diagnosing it. I think a lot of us don't even know when we're angry. We get sick. We get headaches. We get stomach aches. We get tension. And we don't realize we've internalized a lot of anger. Maybe one of the things we can start doing is learning to recognize anger in our body. A young woman I counseled for about a year had some really deep physical problems that we first had her go to a doctor and check out, found out later that they weren't physical at all, and they were related to some anger she had about a father who had died, was alcoholic. And so once we had those feelings out, she was never sick again, and she was able to handle a job and not have any problem at all. Do you know when you're angry? Do you own your anger? Do you learn how to use it, learn how to express it in healthy ways? I think that's important. One of the ways that I've learned to recognize anger in me is by learning the physical symptoms. And I've learned that it's my spinal cord that sends me the message. It tightens up. So one of the things I've tried to do in the last few years is listen to that and say, why am I angry? Is it what my child has said to me? Or is it something that didn't get resolved day before yesterday? Is it something I didn't handle night before last or this morning or a phone call? And so I think learning to identify my anger, learning to analyze it sometimes can save us a lot of hours. During the 19th century, there was a man, a doctor, cardiologist Dr. John Hunter, who had a heart disease known as angina. And Dr. Hunter was learning to live with this disease. As a matter of fact, his physician had told him, well, you can live a normal lifetime, just be careful that you don't, you know, get too excited. Well, he went to him. Look at something like that and think, boy, that's terrible, that's destructive. And yet at the same time, when I may be in a fit of rage, if I can think, this may be fatal to someone's emotional well-being. This is wounding somebody's sense of self-esteem. It may be mine, it certainly is somebody else's. Then I think when I am aware of the power of anger and the need that I have with divine help, I can manage my anger in more healthy ways. You know, I don't know about you, but I think I make a lot of excuses for my own behavior. I think I really do sometimes. I think it's easy to start calling, just sort of sloughing off things, you know. I got angry and I blew everybody in the house. So what? I'm Irish. You know, or it's this reason or it's that reason. And we do sort of disguise things like that. But you know, when we're talking with somebody about drunkenness in their lives, we don't say, well, he's Irish. We might say it's a Scotch in him, I don't know, but we don't say that he's just Irish. But we really have, a tendency, and especially in disposition sense, to talk about them in a flattering way. If we're real stingy with our money and our possessions, we just say we're conservative. You know, we have a euphemism that sort of covers those things up. Well, the next thing I noticed about the elder brother was his stubbornness. He would not go in, the scriptures say. He would not go in. Now, we've got a euphemism for stubbornness. What is it? Strong-willed? Yeah, that helps. That sounds rather positive. A strong-willed person, yes, that's good. Anything else? The one that always tickles me is steadfastness. Oh, steadfast person. Now, there is such a thing as steadfastness. And there is a time to be steadfast. And there are principles upon which we should stand steadfastly. But, you know, most of the time, I'm not being steadfast. I want to confess, I'm being stubborn. Well, let me ask you this. Has anybody in your family ever hinted you might be the least bit stubborn? Just a tad, not much, just a least little bit. You know, I hate to say this, it's terrible, ladies, but our families are experts on our behavior. They really are. And I don't like to face up to that very often, but I think when I get a reading from them about that, it's very important for me to listen. Are we stubborn people? It is tough to live with a mule. It's really tough. It drives you into all sorts of weird behavior to get around the old mule. And you know, I think if we are not careful, we can just sort of slide into that behavior at our churches, in our families, at work, wherever it is. And we want to be aware of that. I guess the next thing that stands out about this boy who stayed at home is his self-righteousness. Oh, the self-righteousness in this statement. I never transgressed a law of yours. All this time, I've been a hard worker at home. Oh, he feels so good about his righteousness, doesn't he? He really doesn't feel the need to confess anything. Oh, wait a minute, I take it back. He does have something to confess. His brother's sins. He wants to bring those out. You know, that's not very good if the only sins we ever confess are our brother's sins, is it? And he says to the father, you know, this son of yours, look what he has done. I mean, everything he's done. Look what you've done for him. And I never did that before. And look at how good I am. Look at how good I am. Oh, it's easy to get in the habit of thinking like that. Now, I don't curse, and I don't chew, and I don't smoke. And there are just really a lot of things that I don't do. I'm really a pretty neat person. I'm a real neat person, as a matter of fact. And you know, just as soon as I start internalizing that message, I start transmitting it. I can't help but transmit it. It's going to stand out from me 10 feet all the way around. It's going to be obvious to people. I remember going to worship a few years ago. It was on a Sunday morning, of course, and our children were much smaller. And we passed an area of really nice homes, well-manicured lawns. Oh, they're gorgeous lawns. And people really pour a lot of time and money and effort in them, and usually they spend most of Sunday on them. And so our son had commented about one of those lawns, you know, and I said in my very pompous way, well, it's too bad they worship their lawns on Sunday. You know, it was a terrible thing to say. And the further I got to church, the more I thought about, oh, but here the McMillans are on their way to church, dressed up and ready. Oh, God, you're so lucky to have the McMillans driving down into this parking lot. And I opened the door and I put my foot out on the cement, and right then, I promise you, the prayer of the Pharisee came into my head. And I thought to myself, I've just prayed that prayer. I have just identified with that. And I think it's so easy for any of us to do that. It's so easy for us to begin to look at somebody waiting on the table and think, huh, what are they doing up there? I know what their teenagers are like, because I've got one and I heard about theirs. Or we see someone teaching a Bible class and you think, boy, what are they doing up there teaching that Bible class? I know about the little fights they have at home. And you know, we just sort of go through a little catalog of things as we see people taking leadership sometimes. And we think about if they were only better, if only people only knew what they're like. I think anytime we start focusing on the sins of other people, a big red light ought to go off right in here. It says, Joy, you're on the wrong track. You're totally on the wrong track. A few years ago, they were having one of those roasts for Burt Reynolds, and I'm not recommending him to you today as your idol, but I think he has some very fine qualities among some very bad qualities. One of the things that I learned about him is he's a very generous philanthropist. He's given thousands and thousands of dollars to help people who are down and out and who needed help. And you know, one of the things they talked about when they discussed Burt Reynolds that night was he had his closet religion. And I thought to myself, and yes, we Christians have our closet sins. There is so much bad in the best of us, and so much good in the worst of us. I really think it behooves us to keep that in mind as we try to relate to people. Somebody has said that our suspicions of other people are largely aroused by our knowledge of ourselves. You know, in psychology, that's called projection. When you project your own motivation on other people, and you project your own flaws and your own foibles and your own weaknesses on other people, and we do a whale of a lot of that. And you know, this elder brother, he said, your son's come back and he's wasted his living with harlots and all that. You know, I don't know how that young person lived while he was in the far country. I don't know what he thought was all that good of a time. But you know what? I know what the elder brother would have done, because he said, right here, he said what he would have done. And I think so many times we make the mistake of judging other people by what we would be doing under those circumstances. Self-righteousness is such a insidious problem for most of us, and there are all kinds of pride that we can develop, and serious sins the Bible talks about. There's economic pride in what I have. where I live, what I drive, who I associate with. I'm in this club and I'm in that club. Then there could be educational pride, people who want to be sure that you understand where they've gone to school and what their degrees are and how qualified they are, and they want you to know that they're in the elite, enlightened group. And then there are people who have what spiritual pride, who have a feeling of superiority over other people in spiritual ways. And that's the feeling that I don't do this and I don't do that and I've never done that and my kids will never do that either. And you just imagine that you've accumulated all this righteousness. And you know, so many times if we really knew the truth of the matter, while I'm sitting over here thanking God that I'm not like that Pharisee, here's a person who's beating his breast and saying, God, I'm so sorry. I've disappointed you. And I've disappointed me. And I've let us all down. And I'm heartbroken about it. And when that person is feeling that way, they're so much closer to God than I am at that moment. Well, there's another thing about this boy. His elder brother, self-pity, kind of a twin sister that goes along with self-pity, and that's that negative spirit that we have sometimes. Feeling sorry for ourselves. You ever do that? I have a neighbor that tells me that once a week at in their neighborhood, they have a pity party.
Melinda Lida.
Very good. Well, you know, a pity party might not be bad once a week. I can see there might be something therapeutic about it. But the problem is some of us could turn it into a lifelong festival, couldn't we? I mean, we can just get in there and wallow around in that stuff and swim around in it, backstroke for a while, just do anything we want to do. Why does everything go right for everybody else? My husband works like a dog, and he never gets his name in the bulletin. They named everybody in the world who sponsored that shower except me. They can just eat dirt next time. Because I'm not doing anything for them anymore. I'll tell you what, I'm so sick of that. I work my fingers to the bone, and what do I get? Bony fingers. That's all I get out of this and nothing more, you know. And on and on and on it goes. A few years ago, I was riding on a plane in a real bad rainstorm. We were trying to land at Pittsburgh, and the person who came on the plane, there had been an elderly couple who'd come on the plane, and the lady was just miserable the whole time. I mean, nothing suited her. She just griped about one thing after another. She didn't like the size of the plane. She didn't like where she was sitting. She didn't like the food. Every time she would say something, her husband was sort of trying to placate her, and now it could be the other way around, ladies, I want you to understand this, but in this case, he was trying to placate her. He just sort of pat her on the leg, and he'd say, "Now, honey, could be worse, and they'd have something else happen. Well, I just don't think, well, I'll do it this way, and he'd say, "Now, honey, it could be worse." So we had kind of a bumpy flight, one of those scary kind, and we finally made a landing, and everybody was very tense. So when we landed and it went well, everybody just applauded. Oh boy, the relief that comes out of that. And he said to her, "Now, honey, wasn't that a wonderful landing?" And she said, "Could have been worse." Could have been worse. You know, I just hate it. I just hate it when people go through life like that. They're just never, never happy. Don't be the kind of person who goes through life brightening a party up by leaving the room. You don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. I think it's just really something I want to challenge you to do, to look for the positive in things. I want to challenge you today. I'm talking about today, that you won't say one single negative thing. When you go back home tonight, you go back to your motel room, you go to pick up the kids, don't say one negative thing. Do you know how bad it's going to be when you get home? Do you know how much work you're going to have to do? It's really going to be hard. But I think we can do that. I think we can learn to look for the positive in any situation. You know, even a broken clock is right twice a day. And so I know that it's possible to do that if we really want to. One time, Ella Wheeler Wilcox was riding on a train. She's a poet. Some of you probably studied her in school. And she watched an interesting thing happen. She said at one end of the train, there was a couple who were just sort of telling about all the catastrophes that had happened to them throughout their lifetime. Kind of a tale of woe and lament, and this thing happened and that thing happened. And she said she noticed that people would sort of sit there a little while, kind of nod politely. Well, I see. Well, that's too bad, you know. And before long, they'd just kind of leave the presence of that person. Somebody else would come along and hear the same story, and they'd wander away. Well, at the other end of the train, she noticed a person who had one funny story after another to tell. I mean, he was just a Hadley Hall, that's all you can say. One funny story after another. And she noticed that people began to gravitate toward this person. And they were just drawn to this person who had something to offer like that. And it caused her to write this poem. Laugh and the world laughs with you. Weep and you weep alone. For the sad old earth must borrow its mirth. It has troubles enough of its own. You know, life is so much like an echo. It tends to come back to us pretty much in the tones that we send out. Very much like that. And if we go through life sending out a tale of woe and lament and always feeling sorry for ourselves and criticizing somebody, that's the kind of response we're going to get from other people. But if you decide to go through life being a cheerful person, a positive person, a Barnabas, an encourager, someone who builds people up, you won't be able to keep friends away from you. You won't be able to count your friends because they will be drawn to you. That's the way life is, and that's the way we are. And so the last thing I think we see in this boy is he slinks out into the darkness. Inside, celebration, happiness, appreciation, love. And here's a boy, miserable because of envy, because of his anger, because of his self-righteousness, because of his inability to be positive. He doesn't have the right attitudes, and he doesn't have the right disposition, and he misses it all. Oh, the struggle of conforming our spirit to the spirit of Christ. But James offers us hope when he says, if any of you lack wisdom, pray to God, and he will help you. I want to challenge each of us today to work on our dispositions, and with God's help, I'm sure we'll all be able to develop more Christian dispositions.